This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network's headquarters here in beautiful, glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, well, I am still on an absolute high because on Tuesday I spoke to Martha Grimes. I was so thrilled. She is actually on my caller ID, and I am still just so excited. I keep looking at it. I'm going to accidentally, I know, call her because she's there, and I never know. But she was so wonderful. Of course, she is a Mystery Writer of America Grandmaster. She's the 10th Grandmaster that I've spoken to since I started this show, and we are celebrating all of March, the 5th anniversary of Joy on Paper. I can't believe it. The actual date is St. Patrick's Day, and 5 years ago when I started the program, it was also a St. Patrick's Day. That's because we had a leap year this year, so it all worked out just perfectly. So on March 17th, I will have on the program two of my favorite authors, and they were on my 4th anniversary program, and that's Tasha Alexander and Andrew Grant. Well, actually, I'm going to have three people. I'm going to have Tasha Alexander, Andrew Grant, and Andrew Child, because that's his new name, now that he's going to be working with his brother Lee Child to keep the Jack Reacher big franchise going. And so it's exciting that I will have all three of them rolled into one. But right now, I wanted all month to talk to people and authors that either my listeners just were crazy about or that I just miss and I haven't had a chance to talk to them. So I'm so excited to have on the program today Peter Riva. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Patsy. How are you?
Okay, great. Well, you know, it is. Usually, I don't have a writer back so soon because I just had you on the program. But first of all, I had so many wonderful, wonderful responses from listeners who were thrilled to hear about you and to hear. You know, of course, they all my listeners all know that I love any book about Africa. I do all the Nat Geo books about Africa. I just anytime somebody's got a book set in Africa, I just grab it. And of course, I love your book set in Africa, Kidnapped in Africa and Murder. Kidnapped on Safari, Murder on Safari, and Berlin Package, which are all centered around absolute wonderful, wonderful characters and all in Africa. But today I thought, you know, I would love to talk about your interest in sci-fi because I've always loved sci-fi. And I tell you, your TAG series is fantastic.
So glad you enjoyed it.
Well,
you know, I grew up with some of the most wonderful writers in science fiction. I was always fascinated by them. I think in the first book I read, I think in sci-fi, was probably Have Space Suit Will Travel. And I think I read it when I was 12. And boy, it made me want to get into space. And of course, I'm old enough to remember those first Mercury astronauts and the joy of getting into space. The space race interested me less, but the notion of space travel has really been something I've always been passionate about. And, of course, science has this way of predicting the future, and science fiction writers are really the best at it. You know, most people listening to you won't know that Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote some of the seminal works in science fiction, was also a scientist, and he came up with the Clarke orbit, which is geosynchronous orbit, upon which all of our telecommunications are dependent. There's a spot 25,000 miles off the equator of the Earth at which you can put a satellite and it stays geostationary. It stays above one spot. And it's Arthur who did the mathematics and calculation of that orbit, and it's called the Clark orbit. You know, science fiction writers either have a deep background in real science, or they have a background of scientific interest and allow their imagination to extrapolate what could be possible. Now, I'm not talking about science fantasy, because that's a different world, but I'm talking about science fiction. And I love science fiction in all forms. David Brin's one of the best writers in the genre, and of course, there's many others. But for me, it always came from small facts and things that I've gleaned. You know, in the path, there's a mention of the Calhoun rat studies. Well, that's a real study. It's still considered secret, which is interesting. It was revealed on Ripley's Believe It or Not on TV some decades ago. Mel Stewart was the director of that series, and he gave me a copy, and I still have it. Can't get it otherwise. The Ford Foundation sort of put a clampers on the whole thing, because the Calhoun rat studies really is a prognostication of what goes wrong when everybody moves to the urban environment away from the natural habitat. And that sort of featured in part of my thinking in writing The Path. I wanted to get to there, because when you create this so-called utopian world, and it's obviously going to be dependent upon machines and artificial intelligence. A lot of people like to write science fiction about artificial intelligence being bad. I think artificial intelligence, when it becomes self-aware, really depends on who the first teacher is. And that's the concept of The Path, is that this rather unassuming guy, Simon Bank, who thinks he's working on a duplicate system to promote errors and therefore make the thing more human, because humanity is based on errors and correcting errors. He thinks he's toying with a duplicate system that's completely isolated from the reality, and when it turns out he's actually working on the real artificial intelligence, and it becomes aware when he's busy mucking around on the insides. And fortunately, he's had a good upbringing, and a rather strange upbringing from his father particularly, that makes him take a position with this burgeoning artificial intelligence child, and gives it the concept of the path. And the path is all about balance, and it's all about do unto others as you would do unto, as you would have them do unto you. And it's really based in that genre.
Well,
and
you know,
so, go ahead.
You know, it's so funny, because of course I found you because of the book set in Africa, which is a passion of mine.
Right.
And then I discovered, of course, that you wrote this series. And I read The Path first, right before I spoke to you the first time. And then I just recently finished reaching Angelica. And I have such an affinity and love for these books, because it's you describe in there about Princeton, computer nerds at Princeton. And my son... Yeah. Was a computer nerd at Princeton. He was programming in C++ at the age of 7. So
wow.
He was a major. I mean, he was one of the most advanced computer kid. He was a Microsoft certified developer at the age of 9. So I know about
wow.
I know about computer nerds, and I know about Princeton, because that's where he was. And so I had such an affinity for this series. I just like, wow, I fell in love with it. And it is beautifully written. Absolutely fantastic.
Oh, that's kind of you. That's so kind. Yeah, I think I had a lot of fun. There's humor in the book because Simon is nothing if not flawed, and of course his nemesis turns out not to be his nemesis, which is kind of fun. And I think the renaming of the AI continually is kind of baffling to some people. But of course, like an original cell, it can clone itself, and sure enough, that's what Apollo does. In reaching Angelica, I decided to allow, shall we say, I don't want to give away the plot
you can't give away the plot. It's hard to say, but it's so good. It's so good.
Well, it's fun when an artificial intelligence realizes that it can go one of two ways. It can either take over and control humanity, or it can allow humanity to be true to itself and therefore remove itself. And that's what the AI in my story does in the end. It doesn't have this megalomania of wanting to own and control things. So therefore, it moves itself out of the picture, allowing humanity to refine itself. That's the concept. Now, of course, I then lay in the fact that there's a lot of other discussion about what is the universe, what is the connection in the universe. This whole notion that space is empty that you and I learned when we were kids is total nonsense. We know that now. And I was listening to a nuclear astrophysicist talk about the connection of energy between all objects, including dark matter in space. And I had just listened about 2 weeks before to a radio program about how the brain in jellyfish works, and it seemed to me to be a direct parallel. So I decided to make the universe a giant jellyfish.
There's just so much in this book. I mean, it's fun. I always enjoy cyberpunk. And in this case, there's so much adventure. There's so much action, because sometimes there isn't as much action in a book. You get sometimes bogged down in describing things as opposed to action. But you have action. You have humor. And your comedic timing is just perfect.
I mean, thank you, Pastor. My favorite scene is where Apollo tells him to jump out the window. I thought that's pretty much... You know, you got to have absolute faith to jump out of a four-story window.
Well, tell us a little bit. Tell us about Zip. Let's go to Zip for a minute.
Well, Zip is, you know, I live with dogs. And anybody who has dogs knows that they understand a whole lot more than people think they do. They just have a limited level of wanting to be involved in the human world because that's way too complicated. But their love and adoration is there all the time, but they always see the truth. And Zip, being an advanced telepathic dog, not only can hear people's thoughts and things and communicate his own, but Zip is also kind of like that grandfather that, you know, always knows the reality and you can never fool him. Zip is always going to set things straight. You know, no, you're not doing that. You're doing this. You know, don't be an idiot. Zip is kind of like the punishing grandfather. I like Zip a lot.
Oh, I think more. And it's funny. You know, I always say there are threads. You know, I think of Joy on Paper as a tapestry, but woven with these magical threads that connect me to people, that suddenly something I will discover about a person that I have been to the same place, perhaps I've been involved in the same area of work or whatever. And in this case, where you have a nerd at Princeton, I mean, that was my son. and Zip is very funny because I've always had an affinity for Zip, the name, just the word Zip. I've named things Zip. As a matter of fact, my husband and I invented a machine called the Zipster. And this machine, which not artificial intelligence, this was sort of a way ahead of its time. The Zipster, which is a beautiful machine, is actually an automated postal machine where you could put your letters in and it did everything almost like magic. And the problem is we invented it 20 years ago before, we were way advanced. The problem is, of course, they realized that it would put like 200,000 people out of work. And so many lawsuits later, the Zipster does not exist, except in our minds and our hearts, because we know that someday on some planet far, far away, we'll have a Zipster. So the minute I read Zip, I said, "Oh, I just love this." It's great when a dog becomes a main character.
Yeah, Zip is sort of a wonderful foible for Simon. Simon can't fool Zip, but Zip is very compassionate. So, you know, Simon has to have something to love, and Zip is clearly it.
Absolutely it. And so, you know, it's hard. You don't want to give away the story, but tell us the path, which took place mostly on Earth or
right.
around Earth, and then how we got to the next level, how we started reaching for Angelica.
Well, I think what became clear to Simon and Apollo and Ra was that life on Earth. First of all, for Simon, because part of the process of his being able to delve into a computer was to change the synapses in his brain and be speeded up. So he couldn't really behave as a normal human on Earth because his teeth would clatter, and it was a physical manifestation of being speeded up, and so his whole body was going to waste itself quickly. So the chances for him staying on Earth were probably minimal, which is why he and his wife moved to space. And I think at the same time, Ra and Apollo were realizing that humanity won't want to be ruled by them, and they don't particularly want to rule humanity. Humans were going to revert to their more base instincts, which they were opposed to, wars and that sort of thing. So for them, the likelihood was that they would have to leave Earth, and one was going to stay behind and help Earth get over some of the most difficult issues, particularly wars, and the other one was going to leave Earth. And they took Simon along with them. One of the bits of feedback I got from the path was that in this utopian world that was brought about by unlimited energy and control of science and weather and growing and all the other infrastructure by AI, that sort of utopian life also meant that you didn't really want to have kids, but you wanted to have kids to a certain time in life. And so synth kids were invented in order to let you have children built from your DNA, but on their 18th birthday, they wouldn't increase the population. They would just go and be recycled, which was very draconian. But it ties in with the idea of a fixed population size, and that people can be rejuvenated themselves, so you could have 5, 6, 7 lifetimes yourself. And that also led to a lot of mental discomfort, particularly for more intelligent people. So in the end, getting off Earth seemed to be the best plan, and getting off Earth with a purpose. And the purpose was to colonize another planet which had been identified. And they sort of set sail, and of course they set sail with a synth kid without the stopgap of 18 years being built in, that Simon takes a new body, and Kramer does the same. Unfortunately, neither of them are waking up, and they're not sure if they're ever going to wake up, and the mission to the new planet is well underway, with Ra being the captain, effectively, and although it's a cooperative society. Finally, they start to wake up, and of course, Simon is immediately heralded as the savior, and he's going to save them all. And of course, Simon doesn't really want to be involved in saving anything. He just would like to get back to being normal, but that's not going to be possible. And he's one of those reluctant hearers, Simon. Kramer is the gung-ho, I'll take control, I'll take care of everything kind of guy. And Simon is more like, really? Do I have to? Okay, I'll figure it out. And it's the duo of the two of those that make a lot of fun. And of course, Ra, with her superior intelligence, because Ra's an AI, which has now also taken the form of a synth kid, the romantic interest springs up there, but I won't say with who.
Yeah, don't.
And Simon is busy trying to figure out the bigger picture, because he realizes early on that there is more going on than just the spacecraft and the journey, because of communications that he and Ra and Apollo have intercepted that show a different entity, a different consciousness. And that can either be a tremendous threat to them or can help them prevail against some of the odds they're going to face. And it's really Simon who's busy trying to unravel some of the mysteries of the universe and finding out that it's so much bigger than anything that he could possibly get a grips with, that he's, in a sense, he has to just let go and put some faith on the line and see what happens.
Well, the rapport between the characters is fantastic, and of course Simon, being the narrator, he's so much that's sort of endearing about him. And you have created a really, I think that anyone who is interested in sci-fi will enjoy this book. And anyone who hasn't really dipped their toe into sci-fi should do so with these books, because, you know, one of the comments that I had from listeners after our last interview was, well, he's so smart. I said, yeah, I think so. I think he's really smart. And they said, well, he does so many things. I said, yeah, he really does. And, you know, it's, I'm not saying that all, you know, let's just say as a writer, you are very well-rounded. You have a lot of knowledge about in so many areas, which I, you know, that comes into play in your writing, because it's seamless. You've already thought about a lot of big things and done a lot of big things in science. And so when you write here, you know, a sci-fi book, there's a basis for it. There's a something that, you know, makes it stand out from some people who just might just sort of think about it or watched a television show. You know, some...
Oh, that's nice of you to say that. I think, Patsy, one of the things that has really struck me over the last 10 or 20 years is that these astrophysicists have begun to realize that the universe is in balance, is in balance. It's balanced. In other words, if you have a galaxy with that much energy in it, there's a parallel one that is exactly the same, its mirror image. And there's this, I would use the word mirror image, of energy, matter, space-time, all of these things seem to be in balance. And of course, I had already written the path with some of that in my mind, that if you can stay in balance with nature, in balance with your diet, in balance with your love and passion, if you can keep in balance, you're more likely to survive. And the universe, it turns out, when you start looking at the billions of galaxies, I mean, really, the numbers are so large that you can't begin to fathom them. You know, it's kind of like somebody the other day said to me that Bill Gates has enough money that if it was in $20 bills, it would go from the Earth to the Moon and halfway back. Well, that's 375,000 miles of $20 bills. I mean, it's too hard to hold in one's brain. Now, mathematicians can do it with numbers and show you how what it means in numbers. But even then, I remember I had a math teacher in high school who said, we're going to spend 2 days counting out loud as a class. And in two classes, we only got to 1,110. People don't realize how big some of these numbers are that we're now getting, you know, told about the deficit is $1 trillion a year and so on. If you started counting today, Patsy, you would have three lifetimes before you got to a trillion. I mean, those numbers are vast. They're huge. And the space is like that. It's just so big that one can't really hold it in our puny brains. But what does seem to be evident are patterns, and the patterns are that everything is in balance. And maintaining that balance and operating within that balance and not destroying it is probably the safest way to proceed. That doesn't mean you don't explore, but you explore with a purpose of maintaining balance. And I think that's one of the great things about the astronauts that I've been privileged to meet and connect with. I mean, even Buzz Aldrin, when he did his Gemini spacewalk, He was sitting in the open doorway, the open hatch of his Gemini spacecraft, and Houston was trying to talk him to get back in for 20 minutes. And he was out there communing with God and nature and the universe because he knew that that was the closest he was ever going to get. He didn't know he's going to the moon yet, but it was the closest he was ever going to get to the infinite cosmos that was in front of him. So he was taking those 20 minutes for himself as a human being, because that's where how he maintained balance. Because it's not just about going into space and coming back. That's all, you know, tick and blob. I did this task. I did that task. I did this rotor and so on. No, he wanted to experience it. Al Bean, one of the greatest astronauts we ever had, he became an artist, and his artwork is phenomenal. If you ever get to see Al Bean's artwork,
I see Al Bean's artwork every day because I had
really?
The privilege of spending time with Al Bean and actually in his studio. I have an autographed one of his lithographs, but. I wrote the script for Walt Cunningham's book.
Really?
Yes, The All-American Boys.
That's great.
So as part of that, the movie was never made. It went into, a lot
of
problems.
Yeah, turnaround.
A spin around, we might call that one. But the thing is, I wrote the script for that book. And the great thing, I actually don't care about the movie. I got to meet and interview so many of the astronauts. Walt Cunningham, of course, I spent a lot of time with his wife. He took me, of course, to Johnson Space Center. I had, you know, behind-the-scenes tours. And, of course, one of them, was Alan Bean. I went to his house. And it's funny when you... I went and I come in the front door and there's these cages. Oh my goodness, what is this? And it turns out his wife raised those little dogs, and she had. But I mean, so I had this opportunity to sit with him and interview him and talk to him, and they are such special people. And this whole idea that here we are, we're going into space, we have these brilliant minds, and now we have more brilliant minds working, and we're hoping to get to Mars. What do you think? We're going to get to Mars?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, sure. And we're going to get somebody there. And sometimes one of the reasons to read this book and to read sci-fi, the possibilities. And then, because sometimes it's awful to come down to Earth and realize there are so many of these little old problems, things that should have been, you know, we should be over, you know. It's like, for you, of course, you spend so much time in Africa, and you see this, you see that the wonder of nature, these beautiful animals, and that people are killing them for no reason, and people are killing a rhinoceros. I mean, it's insane. And you say it's 2020. What's wrong with people when we can...
Well, I have to say that, you know, part of the reason that mankind has evolved as the main changing force on the planet is because at some point in our past, we thought we had the right of having dominion over nature. And we don't treat animals and vegetables and our environment as we treat ourselves, and the end result is we think that we can conquer, control, kill, take what we want, and this isn't a thing about being a vegetarian or not, because if you're a vegetarian, you dig up a carrot, you're killing the carrot to eat it. So at what point is consciousness a level that you want to respect? Is a cow more intelligent than a carrot? Well, on the Glasgow Index, we'd say yes. But what is cosmic consciousness? I have no idea. And I unfortunately, I need to eat, so I eat as carefully as I can, and I'm as humane as I can. But
it comes down again to balance.
Exactly. And you know, try and put back as much as you take out. You know, somebody said to me the other day, well, you know, where do you want to be buried? And I said, well, you know, dig a hole and put me in the ground, put me back to the earth. And they said, well, no, you want to have that, this ceremony. That. I don't want to be cremated. I don't want to be embalmed. Just dig a hole, put me in it. I came from the earth, I go back to the earth. End of the discussion. And people, you know, are getting so far away from the reality of who we really are. I'm not saying that we're not controlling the planet, because we are. We humans move more earth on this planet every year than all the rivers of the world combined.
Wow.
That was first recorded 4 years ago, that humans now move more earth than the earth's rivers move every year. That's an amount of tonnage that is just staggering. And we are like ants on an anthill, and we're devouring our own environment to the point where there will be nothing left. I've been a staunch environmentalist since the early 80s, and Dr. Norman Borlaug, the Nobel Prize winner, gave me a little education. Ted Turner, God bless him, he said, what the hell can I do? I'll tackle one thing, human population, too many humans. I'll give half my money to the United Nations Fund for Population Administration so they go out and educate people that you don't have to have a kid every year. And he wrote a check for $2 billion, which, of course, nobody does. Everybody else says, well, I'm giving this much money, and I'll start a foundation, and I'll hire 400 people. No, Ted just wrote a check. So I've always had more respect for him than most of the other people who's so-called doing things for the environment, because what they're doing is running a new business. Ted just wrote a check and let them go out in the field and have, you know, courses of people. Look, I give you an example. In rural villages in India, where a woman is expected to have a child every year that she can bear a child, because half of them die before they get to be adults, so you just keep having kids and so on, they spent some of that money on a generator, a chicken wire antenna, and a TV set. And every evening, the villagers gather around and watch a soap opera. And the soap opera is propaganda. Happy families have two kids, no more. Miserable families have lots of kids. And all the scripts are written on that basis. And it's called quiet education. It is propaganda, there's no question. But it's trying to tell people that you don't have to have a kid every year. And just slow down the rate of increase of population. In Kenya, the population increase was 5% a year. No country can sustain that. It just can't sustain that. Now it's down at about 2.2%, which is also a little high, but because there's a lot of people there, but it's at least more sustainable than 5% a year. These are things that Ted has really been involved in and wrote a check for, so that people on the ground can go and help. And in my books, I'm not against population. I love people. That's not the issue. The issue is the overconsumption and the domination of nature is imbalance and will come back and bite you.
Well, you know, Peter, I'm going to have so many comments just from talking to you. I don't have much more time, but I want to just thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today to celebrate the 5th anniversary of the program, and to tell people that they really they have multiple choices with you, but definitely your sci-fi series, TAG series, The Path and Reaching Angelica, I think are wonderful, wonderful books, and I hope that, you know, people will go out and get them. And just tell everybody your website. It's Peter Riva.
Oh, thank you, Patsy. It's peterriva.com. It's pretty simple, PETERRIVA.com. But, Patsy, congratulations on your 5 years. That's far more important. Let's talk about that. 5 years you put at this. This is great.
Yes, and it's amazing. And, you know, I talked to the poet laureate, and then the other day I talked to Martha Grimes, which makes the 10th Mystery Writer of America Grandmaster. So, and
that's fantastic.
I've had like 250 New York Times bestselling authors, and all in 5 years. And I started it with absolutely no background in radio or anything else. I was very shy. As a matter of fact, I was always the girl in the corner who was reading a book, or the one person in the room who didn't go for karaoke. so that I did this sort of on a whim. It's quite amazing, and it's been just a great honor to have you on the program, and I hope that you'll come back and we'll talk more. I still would like to talk more about your book set in Africa, because there's so much that I think we can learn. And my listeners, when I got emails from people and calls, and even my neighbor said, boy, you know, they really did say, you're so smart. That was like the most, he's so smart. He knows so much. And they learned so much. And that was important.
Well, thank you, Patsy. Thank you so much. But, you know, I've been listening to your podcast as well, and they're really informative. I've enjoyed them so much.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And I'll say bye for now, but we'll have you back on by popular demand, okay?
Thanks, Patsy. You take care.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye, Peter.
Thank you. Bye.
Wow. What a guy. What an amazing guy. His grandmother was Marlene Dietrich. What can you say? He's an amazing person. Okay, we're going to have a quick commercial, and then I will be back. I have a wonderful, wonderful travel book to talk about.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I am just waiting for a call from Joe Yogerst. Is he on yet? Nope, they'll be calling in a minute from National Geographic. Meanwhile, I just want to tell you that I uploaded my interview with Martha Grimes, the mystery writer of America Grandmaster. It was a wonderful, wonderful interview. As I said, she's number 10. It's been so fantastic. I want to thank particularly Lawrence Block, who started me off with the goal of interviewing as many grandmasters as I could, and of course Carolyn Hart, who was the first grandmaster that I interviewed, and I'm just so thrilled always with her support for Joy on Paper. So it's just been absolutely an exciting month, and the start of the month and the entire month is going to be fantastic. So I have so many wonderful authors coming on, many of them who have become friends over the years. It's for me just an honor to talk to every author. And you know, it's so funny, there are some that you know, now that I've talked to them over and over, I'm starting to really get to know them. I certainly get to know their works. Many authors, of course, I had already read all of their books by the time I started the show. Nelson DeMille, for example, I had read everything that he had ever written. by the time I first spoke to him. Same with David Baldacci, and so many authors, Mary Higgins Clark, who was just so great and a really good friend to Joy on Paper. So now I am going to talk to somebody. I welcome him back. I am so happy to welcome Joe Yogers back. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me again.
Okay, well, you know, you are, I think about you sometimes. Well, I think about you often, actually, because I have your books, my goodness. And the new book, 100 Drives, 5,000 Ideas, Where to Go, When to Go, What to Do, What to See. And I'm thinking to myself, my goodness, Joe, do you ever wonder when you look at your paycheck? Well, you probably don't get a paycheck. They just transfer the money in. Do you ever just look at it and say, my goodness, these people are paying me for something that I'm having so much fun, nobody could call it work?
I sometimes think that way when I'm out on the road. Because when I'm at home and I get the direct deposit, I'm working my little tail off writing these things. And that's what really does seem like work, because as a freelance writer, you have to self-motivate and you have to get up every morning and you have to go to the word factory and put in your time. But when you're out on the road, sometimes I think, wow, somebody really is paying me to do this. So
it's so your books are so good, and they are always conversation pieces, because all you have to do is put it out. Whenever you have visitors come to your house, the first books they go to because the covers are so great, and it's always, you know, 100 something, 100 parks, 100 states, and now 100 yes. drives, and the production value of these books it's so magnificent.
They do a great job. It's a really nice format. It's easy enough to take along with you in the car or on the plane if you're flying somewhere. It doesn't weigh too much. The photographs, I mean, National Geographic just has millions of photos in their archives, and this is drawn from their archives. All the words are mine. The photographs, I have to thank all the photographers who contributed to this book, because they did an amazing job, and the photo editor in Washington, D.C., who picks out these photos.
They are truly amazing, all this time that National Geographic has done these photographs for so many years and just preserved for us to just treasure these views of places, and the ones in this book are quite amazing. And then, of course, your words, you write so beautifully. And I love also what Nat Geo does. They put these little inserts in exactly where to go, where to stay, that kind of thing. So it makes it very, very readable and exactly the kind of book that you want to carry with you when you go. And let's talk about some of these drives. I want to talk first perhaps about the Canada one, because I have my first cousin, and we were raised together, practically inseparable. And she moved to Canada when she was young, got married, and had 8 children. So I've got lots of cousins up in Canada. I haven't been, but I am. She's here right now in Florida. So I'm making a promise to her that I'm going to come up in the summer, because I'm not going up in the winter. But this drive in Canada that you describe is magnificent.
There's a lot of great drives in Canada. A lot of Canadians take road trips in the States, but it doesn't necessarily work the other way around. And it's a great place to go, because I find that the highways are a lot less crowded in general. It's a big country with a lot of back roads, and it has incredible scenery, especially the Rocky Mountains in Canada, and then along the Maritimes, the Atlantic coast.
Well, Alaska Route 1, right?
Yes. There's 3 different drives in Alaska. My favorite one is the one that is the big circle drive through the middle that takes you up to Denali and over to Wrangell St. Elias, and then back through the Chugach Range, which is a drive I did for another National Geographic book. So that had to feature in this, because I was just blown away by that drive.
And what about the route one, the combination of Seward Highway and where it goes? on the peninsula?
Yeah, that's a more, I mean, that's probably the easiest one to take because it's the shortest. But that also starts in Anchorage, and it goes down to Kenai Fjords, and some of the most spectacular scenery anywhere in the world, not to mention the fact that it's full of wildlife. If you're into grizzly bears and whales and things like that, you can also get to the end of that highway and jump in a kayak and go off and kayak camp for a week in the middle of the wilderness and not see another person. And it goes through, you know, kind of the gold country near Anchorage. It also goes to where the Iditarod race starts every year, the starting point of that. And so that's a great drive in Alaska with a lot of variety.
Well, and another one that I would love to do is the dinosaur drive.
Yeah, the Jurassic drive. That's a really good one. From Alberta to Colorado. I would recommend anywhere from 10 to 14 days for that one because there's so much to see along the way. And great places, I mean, national parks along the way, in addition to the dinosaur museums and the dinosaur digs, and incredible countryside landscapes all the way through Montana, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado.
And the nice thing is exactly what I mentioned, that you have these little inserts, sort of pit stops and what to see, where to go, where to stay. So tell us of some of the places that were your favorites, where you stayed and things that people might look for.
In the Overseas Highway in Florida, which was one of the last trips I did for the book, I wanted to stay on Key Largo, and I spent a couple of days there in a tiny little resort called the Kona Kai, which is on the inland side of Key Largo. But they have a tiny little beach, and you can jump in a little kayak there, and you can go out into the mangroves and literally run into alligators in front of your kayak, which to me is a big thrill because I love wildlife.
Okay,
my wife not so much. My wife doesn't want an alligator in the water with us. But
I will agree. Especially we had here not far from me a lady walked out and she had an alligator under her car. So I like a little distance from my alligators.
But it's a great little resort called Kona Kai that we had a great time there. It was a wonderful place to stay that was kind of off the beaten track in the Florida Keys, not nearly as crowded as Key West tends to get. Another place, in the Adirondacks, they had the great camps there that were established during the 1800s by the rich families from New York, the Vanderbilts and Morgans and people like that. And they eventually abandoned those and went and built their vacation homes in the Caribbean and the South Pacific and things like that. But the great camps remained. And a lot of them are now open to the public, either for tours or for staying overnight. And one of the ones I stayed at was Great Camp Sagamore, which was the Vanderbilt compound up there. So it's their idea of rustic camping, but it's basically a mansion in the wilderness. And as an ordinary person, you can go and stay there now. White Pine Camp was another one up in the Adirondacks that I stayed at that has some interesting presidential history and World War I history and espionage connected with it. And that's another one of the great camps from the golden age of the Gilded Age in the Adirondacks. So those are two that come to mind right away.
And then for music lovers, they absolutely have to take the country music roads from...
I mean, a lot of people think that country music was born in Nashville, and Nashville was really the Johnny come lately to country music. It didn't really become a country music hub until the 1950s, or the number one hub until the 50s. It was really born in the Ozarks and the cotton fields of southern Alabama and Mississippi and the Appalachian Mountains. So I have a country music drive that's the Virginia Panhandle and the easternmost part of Kentucky and Tennessee, where bluegrass and country music was really born. And I have another drive across Arkansas through the Ozarks, which is another place country music was born, that I call the Razorback Run, because the Razorback is, you know, the mascot of the University of Arkansas. But so I have two drives in this book that really deal with the roots of country music. And Nashville is, I think there's three different drives that end up going through Nashville. So there's plenty of time to see that part of country music too.
Well, as always, you've done a terrific job with the book. Your writing is fantastic. The nice thing about these books is that you can pick it up over and over. Every time you pick up the book and you read, and then you learn a little bit more and get more enthusiastic. And I think that I'm sure you're getting a lot of feedback from people who have done these tours and gone to the places. That must make you feel really good when you've inspired somebody to go someplace.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole idea, is in all my writing, is that I really hope to inspire someone to go to that place and take these trips. I've thought about this book, you could take a different summer road trip every year for the next 100 years, and still you'd have a couple left over from this book. So, I enjoy hearing people tell me about the road trips they've already been on, and looking at the book and saying, "I really want to do that one next or that one next." After reading what I had to say, it's one of the great thrills of being a writer. Actually, is having an effect on people in that way.
And people can contact you on Facebook. Is that where if they gone on a trip?
I am on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram. I don't do Twitter. I have a website. I have an Amazon authors page and a Goodreads authors page.
Speaking of the Amazon authors page, I would like to invite you to come back on the program in April to talk about your book, because you wrote a book called Nemesis.
I did, yes.
Yes. And so I will be in contact. I will send you a message, and we will find a date sometime in April. I don't know you are, because you're always running around, but we'll find a date that fits you just perfectly, and
sure,
we'll have you on, because I would just love to talk to you about Nemesis, because there's a lot of reasons, and I will explain them when you are on. But meanwhile, I want to tell people, they can go to National Geographic website always to find wonderful books to buy. And if you're looking for just a book that you will enjoy, that everybody who comes to your house will want to steal. Everybody comes to my house, they want to steal your books. And the newest book is 100 Drives, 5,000 Ideas, Where to Go, When to Go, What to Do, and What to See. And it's written by one of the luckiest guys in the world, I think, because you get paid to go to these places. And Joe Yogers, I think you are amazing, a wonderful author, and you've really done a great job with all of your books, and I look forward to talking to you sometime in April about your novel, okay?
I would love to talk about Nemesis. Looking forward to it.
Okay, great.
Right.
Bye-bye now, Joe. Bye.
Take care.
Okay, remember, one of the joys of life is to hear your words in an audible book, or to see them actually in a book in the first place. And because I'm rushing, I have to say, everybody, just I want to thank everybody for all the messages I'm getting for celebrating the 5th anniversary of Joy on Paper. Thank you so much. Go to my website, radio-joyonpaper, to see the lineup of my guests for March. And meanwhile, make sure you say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room, because he is so good to me, and he's saluting me, and I love to be saluted. I should have been in the military. I would have been the greatest general ever. Okay, bye-bye now, everybody. Have a great weekend.